asked. Any idea as to numbers of opposition? The captain nodded. Roughly 40 to 50 men in the barracks, but again, our intention is to keep those men in their buildings so they cannot come into the main building behind you. There are another 10 guards outside at any one time.
And inside the main building?
Unknown. Completely unknown.
Awesome, muttered Caruso.
The captain handed each of the Americans a small LED device called a Phoenix. Ding was very familiar with the beacon. It was an infrared strobe that could be seen at night by the helicopter crews, and theoretically at least, reduced the chance that Chavez and his mates would fall victim to fratricide during the attack. I need your men wearing these at all times.
You got it, said Chavez.
Al Darkour and his American associates were also warned to stay away from any windows while they were in the building, as the Puma helicopters would be full of marksmen targeting movement there. The blinking strobes would be impossible to see from all angles, especially through doorways and windows. After the briefing, Muhammad asked Chavez what he thought about the operation. The American chose his words carefully.
It's a little thin, to tell you the truth. They're going to take some casualties.
Muhammad nodded. They are accustomed to that. Would you like to make some suggestions to make it better?
Would they listen?
No. Ding shrugged.
I'm just a passenger on this bus. We all are.
Al Darkour nodded and said, They will take us along so that we can go after Sam. But please remember, they will not enter the compound. The four of us will be on our own.
I understand, and I appreciate you shouldering the danger with us.
The men were told to rest for a few hours before rallying at the helicopters at midnight. Chavez drilled his two younger partners for a couple more hours, and then all three men cleaned and lubed their weapons before returning to a small hooch near the barracks to lie down on cots. But no one could sleep. They were just hours away from imminent danger. Chavez had spent the entire day getting the two cousins as ready as he possibly could for the action they were about to undertake. He doubted it was enough. Shit, Ding thought. This operation needed a full rainbow squadron, but that wasn't possible. He told the cousins something Clark had told him way back when, on missions where they were poorly equipped.
You got to dance with the one that brought you.
If the Zarar commandos were as tight as their reputation, they'd have a shot at this. And if not... Well, if not, then the conference table at Henley Associates was about to have three more empty chairs. Sitting in the hooch, Ding caught Ryan's eyes drifting away like the kid was daydreaming. Caruso seemed a bit overwhelmed by what was ahead as well. Ding said,
Guys, listen carefully. Keep your head in the game. You've never ever done anything even remotely like what you were about to do. We're going to be up against easily 50 enemy.
Caruso smiled grimly.
Nothing like a target-rich environment.
Chavez grunted.
Yeah? Tell that to General Custer.
Dominic nodded.
Point taken.
The sat phone on Chavez's hip rang just then, so he stepped outside to take the call. While Chavez was outside, Ryan thought about what he had just said. No, he'd never done anything like this. Dom, sitting next to him and reloading his pistol, had not either. The only guys on this force who were ready for a mission like this were Chavez, who would be, thank God, leading the way, Driscoll, who was somewhere at their target location, shackled in a cell maybe, and Clark, who was on the run from his own government as well as others.
Shit.
Chavez leaned back into the door. Behind him, the lights from the helicopters shone, and the noises of men assembling gear nearby rattled like a distant train.
Ryan, phone.
Jack climbed off the cot and headed outside.
Who is it? It's the president-elect.
Damn. This was hardly the time for a familial chat, but Jack realized that he truly wanted to hear his father's voice to help calm his nerves. He answered with a joke.
Hey, Dad, are you the prez yet?
But Jack Ryan Sr. made it clear instantly that he was not in a playful mood.
I had Arnie contact Jerry Henley. He says you were overseas in Pakistan. I just need to know that you are safe.
I'm fine.
Where are you?
I can't talk about...
Damn it, Jack, what's going on? Are you in danger?
Junior sighed.
We are working with some friends over here. You have to choose your friends carefully in Pakistan.
I know that. These guys are risking everything to help us.
Ryan Sr. did not respond. Dad, when you get in office, are you going to help Clark?
When I get back to Washington, I'll move mountains to get his indictment overturned. But for now, he is on the lam, and there's not a damn thing I can do about it.
Okay.
Do I hear helicopters in the background?
Yes.
Is something going on?
He knew he could have lied right now, but he did not. It was his father, after all.
Yes, something is going on. Something much bigger than a couple weeks ago. And I'm in the middle of it. I don't know how it's going to play out.
A long, pained pause on the other end of the line. Finally, Ryan Sr. said,
Can I help?
Right this minute? No.
But you definitely can help.
Just say the word, son. Anything I can do.
When you get into office, do whatever you can to help the CIA. If you can get them as strong as they were when you were president last time, then I'll be a lot better off. We all will.
Trust me, son. Nothing is more important. Once I get...
Chavez and Caruso stepped out of the hooch with grease paint on their faces and their bodies laden with gear.
Dad, I need to go.
Jack, please be safe.
Sorry, but I can't be safe and be here. And my job is here. You've done things. You know how it is.
I do.
Look, if something happens to me, tell Mom... Just try to make her understand.
Jack Jr. heard nothing on the other end, but he sensed his father, stoic though he was in agony with the knowledge that his son was in imminent danger, and there was not a damn thing he could do to help him. The younger Ryan hated himself for putting his father in this position, but he knew he did not have time to undo the damage he had just caused by making him worry.
Gotta run. I'm sorry. I'll call when I can.
If I can, he thought, but he did not say it. And with that, Jack disconnected the phone and handed it back to Chavez, then stepped back into the little hut to grab his weapon. 64. The four Puma helicopters crossed into North Waziristan just after 3 a.m. The fat choppers flew low and close together to mask their approach, using roads through the mountains and deep river valleys to direct them toward the target of the town of Aziz Kel. Ryan fought nausea as he sat on the floor of the helo, looking out at the dark landscape outside. He actually got to the point where he wanted to vomit all over himself, to rid himself of any food or water in his stomach, so that he might recover before go time. But he did not throw up. He just sat there, pinned tightly between Muhammad al-Darkur on his right and Dom on his left. Chavez faced them, and five more Zarar commandos sat with him in the chopper, along with a door gunner manning a 7.62mm machine gun and a loadmaster who rode up front near the two pilots. The other choppers would be loaded up much the same. Chavez shouted over the engine's roar.
Dom and Jack, I want you two guys on my back the whole time we're inside the walls. Keep your weapons at the high and ready. We move as a unit.
Ryan had never experienced terror like this in his entire life. Everyone for 50 miles in every direction, save for the men in the four choppers, would kill him if they saw him. Al-Darkur had been wearing a headset to communicate with the flight crew, but he pulled it off and replaced it with his helmet. He then leaned over to Chavez and yelled,
It is almost time. They will circle for 10 minutes, no more. Then they leave us.
Got it, Ding answered back.
Ryan leaned forward into Chavez's black greased face.
Is 10 minutes enough time?
The diminutive Mexican-American shrugged.
If we get bogged down in the building, we're dead. The whole place, inside and out, is crawling with Haqqani's forces. Every second we are in there is a second some Gomer has to draw a bead on us. If we aren't out in 10 minutes, we ain't coming out, Mano.
Ryan nodded, leaned away, and looked back out the window toward the undulating black hills below. The chopper lurched up dramatically, and Jack spewed vomit against the glass. Sam Driscoll had no idea if it was day or night. Usually, he could make a guess as to the time of day going by the guard rotation, or whether or not his meal was just bread, morning, or bread with a small tin of watery broth, night. After weeks in captivity, he and the two men still held with him had begun to think that the guards had switched the meals up to confuse them. A Reuters reporter from Australia was in the cell next to him. His name was Alan Lyle, and he was young, not over 30, but he was sick with some sort of stomach virus. He had not been able to keep anything down for the past few days. In the furthest cell, the one closest to the door to the hallway, an Afghani politician was held. He'd been here only a few days, and he was getting occasional beatings from the guards, but he was in otherwise good health. Sam's leg had healed for the most part in the past month, but he had a significant limp, and he could tell he had not avoided infection altogether. He felt weak and sick, and he perspired through the night, and he'd lost a great deal of weight and muscle tone lying on his rope cot. He made himself stand and hobble over to the bars so that he could check on the young guy from Reuters. For the first week or so, the man badgered him relentlessly, asking him who he worked for and what he was doing when he was captured by the Taliban. But Driscoll never answered the guy's questions, and Reuter's man finally gave up. Now it looked like Reuter's man might give up on his life within a few days.
"Hey," Sam shouted. "Lyle, wake up."
The reporter stirred. His eyes opened to half-mast.
"Is that a helicopter?"
Fucking delirious, Sam thought. Poor bastard. Wait. Sam heard it now, too. It was faint, but it was a chopper. The Afghan by the door stood and looked back to Sam for some confirmation as to what he was hearing. The three jailers outside the cell heard it, too. They looked at one another, then stood and peered down the dark hallway, shouting to a guard somewhere out of Driscoll's sight. One of the men made a joke, and the three laughed. The Afghani politician looked to Driscoll and said,
"They say it is President Kilty coming to look for you and the reporter."
Sam sighed. It wasn't the first time they'd heard Pakistani army choppers overhead. They always faded after a couple of seconds. Driscoll turned to go sit back down, and then, boom! A low crack erupted somewhere above him. Sam turned back to the hall. Machine gun fire came soon after, and then another explosion.
"Everybody get down on the floor!" Driscoll shouted to the other prisoners.
If this was a rescue attempt by the PDF, and if there was any shooting down here, even out in the hall, then there would be ricocheted rounds banging all around this stone-walled basement, and friendly fire would hurt just as bad as enemy fire. Sam started to look for some measure of cover himself, but one of the jailers came to his cell. The man's eyes were wide with fear and determination. Sam got the impression this fucker was going to use him as a human shield if the PDF made it down into the basement. They'd been off the helicopter for nearly 2 minutes, and Jack Ryan had not yet seen the enemy. First, they dropped into a knee-deep trash pit some 100 yards from the target. Jack could not understand why the pilot had dumped them so far from their target until, upon running closer to the compound, they saw several rows of electricity poles and wires crisscrossing the open ground in front of the main gate. Then, while Chavez set the water-tamped breaching charge at the perimeter gate, Jack, Dom, and Muhammad watched his six. They dropped to their knees and scanned the dark rooftops and gates of a cluster of walled compounds on the other side of a rocky plain, and they kept their eyes on the corners of the wall of the Haqqani compound to the north and south. Above them, the big Puma choppers circled, occasionally emitting jackhammer bursts from door guns or staccato cracks from Zarar commandos, firing their small arms into the compound. A 20-millimeter cannon fired from one of the fat birds sent explosive rounds into the hillside beyond the compound in order to let the 40 Taliban supposedly in the barracks know that they needed to stay right where they were. Finally, over the hellacious sounds from above, Jack heard,
"Fire in the hole!"
and he found cover by pressing himself against the 14-foot-high baked brick wall. Just seconds after this came the boom of the breaching charge, blowing the black oak and iron gates of the compound in like tossed toothpicks. And then, just like that, they were inside the walls, running for the main building 30 yards ahead. Ryan saw the long, low barracks some 40 yards off his right shoulder, and just as he looked, tracer rounds kicked up sparks near the dark structure from machine guns fired from above. Jack was tied on Dom's heels, and Muhammad was just behind Jack, all the men running behind Chavez, who led the way with his AUG at his shoulder. Jack was surprised when Chavez fired his rifle ahead. Ryan looked to see where the bullets were impacting, and saw they were tearing up a small building or garage to the left of the main house. From there, a bright light flashed and a rocket-propelled grenade launched into the sky, but it seemed to have been poorly aimed. Ding fired again and again. Ryan got his P-90 up to send some rounds downrange himself, but the team arrived at the wall of the main house before he even found a target in the night. They scooted down the wall, closer to the front door, Ding still in the lead. Chavez nodded to Caruso, who quickly raced across the closed door and pressed up against the wall on the other side. Chavez nodded to Ryan, who started to pull a stun grenade from a pouch hanging on his right thigh. But as he reached for it, he saw a second and a third RPG flying through the air, launched from the grounds behind the main building. Both grenades looked like they were perfectly aimed at a Puma that flew nearest to the barracks buildings. And they were. The first RPG streaked right by the pilot's windscreen, and the second slammed into the tail just aft of the two engines. Ryan stood fascinated, watching as the tail exploded and the aircraft spun away to the right, turned nose down, and disappeared behind a plume of black smoke. The crash came outside the wall, lower on the rocky plain. Immediately, one of the three remaining helicopters veered out of its tight circular pattern around the Haqqani compound and flew off toward the crash.
"Shit," said Chavez. "We're losing our cover. Let's go."
65. Dom kicked open the front door of the house, and Ryan tossed his stun grenade into the entry hall, staying just to the left of the doorway and out of the line of fire from inside the building. Boom! All four men rushed in. Dom and Ryan went to the right, and Ding and Muhammad shifted to the left alongside the wall. They used flashlights mounted onto their weapons to illuminate a dark, open room. Almost instantly, Dominic saw movement through a doorway on the right. He shifted his light's beam. It flashed off the metal of a rifle, and Caruso fired a 10-round string of fire into the doorway. A bullet-riddled bearded man fell out into the room by a wooden table. His Kalashnikov tumbled out of his hands. Behind him in the courtyard, small arms fire crackled. These were not guns fired from circling pumas. No, these were AKs from the compound's guard force. The fire picked up, and it became clear that the men in the barracks had broken out. They were either targeting the choppers or heading toward the main building. Perhaps both. Chavez, Caruso, Ryan, and Aldarpur moved in a tactical train down a low hallway, clearing a few rooms on the left and right as they moved, using the same wall flood tactics they had used to breach the first room. They'd hit a doorway, enter fast with guns high and lights on, the first and third men moving up the wall to the left of the entrance, and the second and fourth men going right. After the third empty room, they came back into the hallway, and Muhammad Aldarkur cut down two men trying to enter the front doorway. After that, he dropped to his knee pads, keeping his gun trained on the door where men from the barracks would enter.
"Keep going! I'll keep them back!"
Chavez turned and led the way, with Ryan and Caruso right on his heels. They made a turn. Ding shot at a gunman retreating up a staircase on his left, then knelt to reload his gun. There was another stone staircase on the right, heading down into a basement enshrouded in darkness. Outside, large RPG explosions were mixing with small arms fire. Domingo turned back to the others, now shouting over the sound of Aldarkur's cracking rifle.
"We don't have any time. I'll check upstairs, you guys go down. Meet back here, but watch out for blue-on-blue fire."
With that, Chavez hustled up the stairs and out of view. Caruso took a tentative lead down into the basement, shining his light ahead of him. He'd gotten no more than halfway down the uneven stone steps when a rifle up ahead boomed, and the steps and walls sparked around him as copper-jacketed ammo struck and bounced. Caruso backpedaled up the stairs, but crashed into Ryan. Both men fell and tumbled forward, sliding down the stairs on their gear packs before coming to rest in the dark hallway. The gunman ahead continued firing. Ryan found himself on top of Caruso, pinning his cousin down, so he rose to his knees, aimed perfunctorily on the flashes ahead, and dumped 20 rounds from his weapon at the threat. Then, through the ringing in his ears, he heard the clinking of his own hot brass bouncing against the stone before it came to rest all around him. Then he heard a heavier metal thud as a rifle fell to the floor ahead. He shined his light and saw a Taliban slumped against the wall at a turn in the basement hall.
"You okay, Dom? Get off of me."
"Sorry." Ryan climbed off and stood up. Dom stood up as well, and then covered ahead while Jack reloaded his P-90.
"Let's move."
They made it to the corner and then looked around. Up ahead was a single room at the end of the hall. Inside it was dark, but not for long. AK fire from two rifles rang out, sending showers of sparks all the way up the hall toward the two Americans as the bullets pinged off the stone wall. Dom and Jack tucked their heads back.
"I'm thinking that looks like it could be the jail."
"Yeah," agreed Ryan. Apparently, there were only two jailers, but they had good cover at the far end of the hallway. Plus, they held a second advantage. Jack and Dom had no idea what was on the other side of the doorway. For all they knew, if they fired up the baked brick hallway and into the room, their rounds might bounce around inside and hit the man they had come to save.
"Should we go get Chavez and come back?" asked Ryan. "No time. We've got to get in there."
Together, they thought for a moment. Suddenly, Jack said, "I've got an idea. I take a 9-banger, I throw it short, just outside the doorway. As soon as the first bang goes off, we run."
"Into the 9-banger?"
Caruso asked incredulously.
"Fuck yes. We shield our eyes. They'll have to pull their heads in the room while it's going off. When we get halfway up the hall, you roll a flashbang through the doorway, and that should stun them until we get in. We'll have to time it right, but that should keep them occupied."
Dom nodded.
"I don't have anything better. But leave your rifle, pistols only. We'll move better, and we don't want to hit Sam coming through the door."
The two young men slipped out of their rifle slings and then pulled grenades from their chest pouches. Ryan drew his pistol and pulled the pin on his grenade. Dom moved next to him at the edge of the corner. He patted his cousin on the shoulder and said,
"No retreat.
We start moving on that position. We can't stop and turn back around. The only chance is to keep going.
Got it, Jack said, and he slung the grenade around the dark corner with a sidearm toss. After just a couple of echoing metal-on-stone clanks, the first explosion and flash rocked the hall and the men at the far end of it. Dom moved ahead of Jack, sprinted into the 40-foot-long line of fire of the enemy's guns, and he rolled his flashbang far into the room like a bowling ball, right through the flashes and smoke of Jack's nine-banger. Together, Caruso and Ryan ran forward with their eyes turned away from the bursts of fire. The two jailers had tucked their heads back inside the small room to shield them from what they thought was an undertossed diversion. But by the time the last of the nine-banger's pops finished, and they ready to turn back to resume firing up the hallway, a small canister bounced into the room between them. They both stared at the flashbang as it went off, pounding their brains inside their skulls and dilating their blinded eyes. Jack entered the room first at a run, but he'd caught enough of the effects of Dom's flashbang to disorient him. He ran right past the two men who'd fallen to the floor on either side of the doorway, and he crashed into the metal bars of the first cell before he was able to stop on his own. "Fuck!" he shouted, half-blinded and all deaf, at least for the next few seconds. But Dominic came in behind him. Jack's body had shielded him from much of the light and some of the sound, so the ex-FBI agent still had his wits about him. He shot both of the disoriented Haqqani fighters where they knelt on the floor, putting a bullet into the back of each man's head.
"In here!"
It was Sam. His cell door was only a few feet from Ryan, but he could barely hear him. Ryan shined his light on the cells in the room. A Pashtun man was crouched against the wall of the first cell. A sick-looking white-skinned blonde man lay on the floor of the second cell. Ryan now shined his light into the corner. In the last cell, Sam Driscoll sat astride a dead Haqqani fighter, the man's twisted neck in the American's hands. Caruso found the overhead light and flipped it on. He stared at Sam as well.
"You okay?"
Sam looked away from the man he had just killed with his bare hands, the jailer who had planned to use him as a human shield. And he looked up at his two colleagues.
"You boys playing army?"
66. Sam and Dom led the way back up the stairs, while Jack and the Afghan carried the incapacitated Reuters reporter. It was a tough climb back to the ground floor, but once they were there, things became even more precarious. Chavez had cleared the upstairs, but now he and Aldarkur were in the hallway near the stairs, firing toward the front of the building at enemy fighters positioned there. The Pakistani major had been hit in the left shoulder, and his rifle had been damaged by another round, but he continued to fire his pistol up the hall with his right hand. Chavez saw that he had six people behind him now, and one was being carried. He nodded to himself and patted Aldarkur on the shoulder.
"Let's find a way out of here before the enemy starts firing RPGs."
They headed toward the back of the building, a limping Sam Driscoll in the lead with a salvaged AK. Now Chavez brought up the rear and fired constantly to keep heads down in the rooms and hallways near the front of the house. The hallway came to a T, and Driscoll went right, with the rest of the procession following behind. Sam came upon a large room at the back of the house, but the windows had been bricked up and there was no door.
"No good," he shouted. "Try the other direction."
Chavez led now. He was surprised that the enemy fire up this stretch of hallway had lessened noticeably. With Ryan and Caruso firing down the base of the T, Chavez and Aldarkur darted across and then ran into a long, narrow kitchen. There was no exit here, but a small side door looked promising. Chavez opened the door, desperate to find a window or a door or even a staircase back upstairs. The doorway led to a dark room roughly 15 feet across and 30 feet deep. It seemed to be some sort of repair shop, but Ding didn't focus on the room itself. Instead, he shined his rifle's light quickly along the walls, searching for any other exit. Seeing nothing, he started to turn away to try to go back and fight with the others, but he stopped when something caught his eye in the low light. He'd ignored the wooden tables and shelves in the room when looking for a way out, but now he focused on them, or, more specifically, what was on them. Containers of car parts and electrical components, batteries, cell phones, wires. Small drums of gunpowder, steel pressure plates, and a blue 55-gallon drum full of what Ding immediately assumed was nitric acid. On the floor were mortar shells, partially disassembled. Ding realized he'd stumbled onto a bomb factory. The improvised explosive devices created here would be smuggled over the border into Afghanistan. This explained why the Haqqani fighters hadn't fired a rocket toward Chavez and his team here in the back of the house. If anything in this room detonated, The entire compound would be obliterated, the Haqqani men included.
Mohammed,
Ding shouted, and Al-Darqur peered into the room. Immediately he nodded.
Bombs. I know what they are. Can we use them?
Mohammed nodded with a crooked smile. I know something about bombs. Ryan and Caruso were both down to their last magazine. They fired individual rounds from the top of the tee down to the base. They knew they'd taken out a lot of the Haqqani members with rifle fire, but there seemed to be an unlimited supply of armed assholes remaining. One of the Puma helicopters was flying in circles behind the compound. This Jack could tell from occasional automatic fire from a 6 o'clock high coming from outside the building. He could not actually hear the helo. With the gunfire in the narrow hallways, his ears were trashed, so nothing less than small arms fire up close or heavy machine guns at distance registered. Chavez appeared just behind the two men, sliding a fresh magazine around and into their chest rigs. While he did this, he shouted,
"There's a bomb factory in the back!"
"Oh shit," said Ryan, realizing that he and his mates were, essentially, exchanging fire while sitting on top of a powder keg.
"Al-Darqur is wiring an IED to blow the back wall. If he gets it right, it should make us a hole in the back of the building. When it's time to go, just turn and run up the hallway. I'll cover your egress."
Jack didn't ask what would happen if Mohammed did not get it right. Ding next said,
"Do not head out back until you toss your LZ beacons. The door gunner in the Puma has been rocking his MG for the past 10 minutes. Don't count on him to spot the IR strobe on your back. He'll turn you into ground beef. Use your LZ marker as a second way to alert them that friendlies are coming out."
The two young men nodded.
"Sam and the Afghan will drag the wounded man. You guys just keep up the covering fire for them until the chopper lands and they get on board."
"Got it,"
Dom said, and Ryan nodded. Both Ryan and Caruso kept up the controlled fire, just enough to let the enemy know that if they ventured up the hall toward the tee, then they were going to pay a heavy price. They still took some fire, but it came from AKs that were just held around the corner and sprayed by their handlers, and the rounds banged along the walls, floors, and ceiling. Twice, Al-Darqur and Chavez passed behind them as they took IED material out of the bomb factory on Jack and Dom's right and carried it to the other end of the hallway on their left. Within a minute, Chavez was back behind them. He screamed into their ears,
"Get down!"
Both men dove to the stone floor of the hallway and covered their heads. Within a few seconds, an incredible boom from behind them pounded up the hallway with a concussive force that made Jack think the building would fall on top of them. Cracked mortar, stone, and dust did fall from the ceiling, raining down on all the men in the hallway. Caruso was first to his feet. He ran up the hallway with Ryan close behind, passing the wounded Reuters man being dragged by his shoulders by Driscoll and the Afghani prisoner. Jack caught up to him as they entered the room with the bricked-over windows. Their weapon lights were useless with the dust in the air. They just continued on toward the far wall until finally they could see open sky. Immediately, Dominic threw the flashing landing zone signal into the rear of the compound. The beacon would, in theory, alert the gunmen in the circling choppers that friendlies were in that area so they should not fire. As Dominic stepped into the rear courtyard, he worried he would take a blast from the door gun of the chopper, but fortunately, the Zarar commandos had good fire discipline. The American crouched behind a small stack of truck tires and covered the north side of the compound, while his cousin went prone beside a large pile of rubble left by Al-Darqur's bomb blast covering the south side. One of the SSG choppers had used its 20mm cannon to take out the poles holding up the electric wires in the back of the property, so the helo landed near Major Al-Darqur, the prisoners, and the American operatives. Within seconds, everyone was aboard and the helo lifted back into the air and immediately began racing for safety. Inside the helicopter, all 7 men who'd made it on board lay on the metal decking, arms and legs atop one another. Jack Ryan found himself near the bottom of the pile, but he was too exhausted to move, even to push the thick leg of the Afghani politician off his face. It took another 20 minutes of nap of the earth flying before the lights in the cabin of the helo came on and the pilot announced, through Mohammed Al-Darqur and his intercom linked headphones, that they were out of danger. The men sat up, water bottles were passed around, and Al-Darqur's shoulder was attended to by the loadmaster of the aircraft, while one of the Zarar commandos started an IV into the arm of the Australian Reuters correspondent. The normally dry and stoic Sam Driscoll hugged each member of his extraction team, then he rolled into the corner and fell asleep with a water bottle tucked to his chest. Chavez leaned over into Jack's ear to yell over the engine noise.
"Looks like you had a pretty close shave back there."
Jack followed Ding's eyes to the canvas magazine rack on his chest. A jagged hole was torn through one of the pouches. he pulled out a metal and plastic P90 mag and found a bullet hole all the way through it. Fingering his way into the hole in his chest rig, he fished out a twisted and sharp 7.62 round that had slammed into a ceramic breastplate. In all the action, Jack had no idea he'd taken a hit right to the chest. "Fuck me," he said as he held the bullet up and looked at it. Chavez just laughed and squeezed the younger man's arm.
"Not your time, mano."
"I guess not," Jack said, and he wanted to call his mom and dad, and he wanted to call Melanie. But he had to put both those communications on hold, because he suddenly felt the nausea return. 67. Riaz Rian had men on the inside of each and every major institution in his nation. One of these institutions was the Pakistani nuclear ordnance industry. He, through his own network of cutouts, was in contact with nuclear scientists, engineers, and weapons manufacturers. Through them, he learned that in Wak cantonment near Islamabad was the storage location of many of his nation's nuclear devices. Several air delivery bombs, essentially U.S. Mark 84 conventional bomb cases packed with 5 to 20 kiloton yield nuclear devices, were kept at the Kamra Air Weapon Complex inside the massive Pakistan ordnance factories there at Wa. The nuclear bombs were disassembled, but kept at something known as screwdriver-ready status. This meant they could be assembled for deployment in hours if and when the head of state called for them to be made ready. And Rian had learned from one of his high-ranking associates in the Ministry of Defense the previous morning, the President of Pakistan had made the call. So the first portion of Operation Saker had already succeeded. In order to ensure that the weapons were assembled and deployed to their battle stations, General Rian needed to bring his nation to the brink of war. That done, he monitored his contacts in the government and nuclear weapons branches of the military and waited like a coiled snake in the grass to make his next move. The Pakistanis had long boasted that their nuclear weapons were protected by a 3-tier National Command Authority security procedure. This was true, but ultimately it did not mean much. All one needed was the knowledge of the weakest link in the security of the device after its assembly, and some way to exploit this weakest link. The general's agents at Pakistan Ordnance Factories told him that around 9 p.m., two 20-kiloton bombs would leave the Kamra Air Weapon Complex by truck, and then they would be delivered to a special train in nearby Taxila. At first, Rian considered attacking the truck convoy. A truck is easier to disable than a train, after all. But there were too many variables for which Rian could not control so close to the large military presence there in Wa and Taxila. So he began looking at the rail route. The bombs would be delivered by a heavily guarded freight train to the Air Force Base at Sargota, some 200 miles of rail travel away. A simple glance at a map was all it took to pinpoint the weakest link on the route. Just 5 kilometers south of the town of Fularwan, on a flat stretch of farmland bisected by the railroad, a cluster of abandoned mills and grain warehouses sat alongside wheat fields that ran right up to the tracks. Here a force could hide, ready to attack a train approaching from the north. Once they had achieved their objective, the force could then load itself and the two 10-foot-long, 1-ton bombs onto trucks and access the modern M2 highway, the Lahore-Islamabad road, where they could go north or south and disappear into either massive metropolis inside of 90 minutes. In the first week of December, a cold, steady rain fell, beating on the tin roofs of the grain shacks that lay just 400 yards from the edge of the rail line. General Riaz Rian, his second-in-command, Colonel Khan, and Georgi Safronov lay on prayer mats in the dark, tucked in a shed behind a rusted-out tractor that hopefully would afford them protection from stray gunfire when the attack commenced. Rian was awaiting a radio call from a spotter in Chabapurana, a village just southeast of Fularwan. The 55 Jamaat Shariat gunmen, the students from the Haqqani camp in Miran Shah, were spread out in the field on the west side of the tracks. They were positioned one man every 3 yards, and every fourth man held a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, and the rest wielded Kalashnikovs. The Dagestanis, led by ex-ISI officers hand-picked by General Rian because of their paramilitary experience, were positioned 50 meters or so away from the track, and a 10-meter-long stretch of rail had been removed just moments before. The speeding train would come off the rails right there in front of Jamaat Shariat. It would grind into the dirt, and then the North Caucasus fighters would quickly go to work, killing every last living thing in each and every car. Rian had forbidden smoking ever since the 6 big truckloads of men arrived earlier in the evening. Even though there was no one around for several kilometers in each direction, he also forbade speaking other than in a whisper, an all but essential radio communication. Now his radio crackled to life. It was on an encrypted channel, but still the message was in code.
Ali, before you go to bed, the hens must be fed. They will be hungry.
Rian patted the nervous Russian space entrepreneur crouched in the shed with him, then leaned into his ear.
That is my man up the tracks. The train is coming.
Safronov turned to Rian and looked to him. Even in the low light of a rainy night, the man's face looked pale. There was no reason for Safronov to even be here for this attack. Rian had argued against it, telling the Russian that he was too precious to the overall mission. But Safronov had insisted. He demanded to be with his brothers each step of the way on this operation. Though he had left the training early in North Waziristan, that was only because, at that point, he was working 20-hour days in Moscow, organizing the 3 rocket launches in Baikonur, and ensuring that only his hand-picked scientists and staff would be there with him when the time was right. But there was no way he would have missed tonight's fireworks, Rian's dominant personality be damned. Rian had finally acquiesced to letting Georgi come along for the op, but he held his ground on having him take no part in the attack itself. He even demanded that the man wear a chest plate and remain in the shed until they loaded everything on the trucks, and Rian had put Colonel Khan himself in charge of making sure the Dagestani remained safe. There were a few other men nearby as well who would not be part of the gunplay because they played a bigger role in the op. The cold, calculating general knew that selling the fantasy that a band of mountain men from Dagestan could pull off such an incredible operation in Pakistan would be difficult, if not impossible. Many in the know would immediately place blame on the Islamists and the ISI for helping them. To deflect this blame, Rian had set up one of the organizations with whom he'd been working for more than a decade. The Muslim United Liberation Tigers of Assam, an Islamic militant group in India, had been penetrated by agents from India's National Investigation Agency a year prior. When Rian learned of Multa's infiltration, he did not get angry, and he did not immediately cut ties with them. No, he saw this as an opportunity. He took men from Malta who were insulated from the NIA penetration, and he brought them into his fold. He told them they would be part of an incredible operation in Pakistan that would involve stealing a nuclear weapon, returning with it to India, and detonating it in New Delhi. The men would be martyrs. It was all a lie. He documented their movements, as he documented Indian intelligence's infiltration of their organization, saving evidence that he could use later to cover the tracks of the ISI and the theft of the bombs. He had plans for the 4 Malta men here tonight, but it had nothing to do with them leaving these fields with the bombs. These men would take the fall for the theft of the weapons, and by association, the Indian government would have to explain their involvement with the group. In furtherance of this ruse, Rian and his men planned the attack with an appearance of sloppiness. A group of Islamic fighters from India, being duped by Indian intelligence into working with Dagestani partisans in Pakistan, would not possess any semblance of military precision, and for this reason, the plan involved mayhem and chaos to achieve its objective. Rian heard a radio call from the unit farthest to the north. They reported the lights of the train in the distance. The mayhem and chaos would begin within moments. Rian's plan never would have worked if the Pakistani government put as much effort into securing its nukes from terrorists as it did securing them from their neighbors to the east. The bomb train could have been longer, full of an entire battalion of troops. It could have had helicopter gunship escorts for the entire route, and the Pakistani Defense Force could have stationed quick-reaction troops along the tracks in advance of the trains leaving Kamra on its way to Sargodha Air Force Base. But all these high-profile measures that would virtually eliminate the chance that a terrorist group could overpower the train and take the weapons would also telegraph to Indian satellites, drones, and spies that the nukes were under deployment. And the Pakistani Defense Force would not let that happen. Therefore, the security plan for the train relied on supreme stealth and an onboard force of 1 company of troops, just more than 100 armed men. If stealth failed and terrorists hit the train, 100 men would, under virtually all circumstances, be sufficient to repel an attack. But Rian was prepared for 100 men, and they would not stand a chance. The lights of the train appeared in the flat distance, just a kilometer away now. Rian could hear Safronov's heavy breathing over the pattering of the rain on the tin roof. In Arabic, the general said, "Relax, my friend. Just lie here and watch.
Tonight, Jamaat Shariat will take a first important step in securing a Dagestani homeland for your people. The Pakistani's voice was full of confidence and fake admiration for the fools out there in the grass. Inwardly, he was hoping they wouldn't fuck it up. Out there with Jamaat Shariat were a dozen of his own men, also ready with small arms and radios to organize the attack. He had no idea how well the Haqqani trainers had prepared these 55 mountain men, but he knew he was seconds away from finding out. The train itself appeared in the rain, screaming forward in the night behind its white light. It was not long, only a dozen cars. Rian's contacts at Kamra Air Weapon Complex had no way of knowing which car the devices would be loaded into, and he had no one at Taxila Railroad Station to confirm this either. Obviously, it would not be in the engine, and common sense said it would not be the rear car, as the security detail would logically post a portion of the force at the back in case of attack from the rear. So Jamaat Shariat had been ordered to fire their RPGs only at the engine and the last car, or at any large clusters of dismounted troops only when they were well away from the train. The RPGs could not set off a nuclear explosion, even if they hit the bombs themselves, but they could very easily damage the weapons, or set the rail car containing them on fire, and make it difficult to extract the two big bombs. Again, Rian worried. If this did not work, his plan to take control of the nation was dead. The conductor of the deployment train must have seen the missing portion of track ahead. He slammed on his brakes, and they squealed and screeched. Georgi Safronov tensed perceptibly behind the rusty tractor with General Rian and Colonel Khan. Rian started to calm him with gentle words, but suddenly, a Kalashnikov rifle opened up, firing fully automatic while the train was still moving. Another AK joined the chorus, the sound barely perceptible over the incredible noise of the brakes of the locomotive. Still, Rian was furious. Jamaat Shariat had jumped the gun. Rian shouted into his radio at his men in the field.
They were not to fire until the train derailed. Shut those bastards up, even if you have to shoot them in the head.
But just as he finished his transmission, the heavy engine skittered off the track. Behind it, like a slowly collapsing accordion, the other cars turned both in and out. The train came to a slow, labored stop in the rain. Small fires ignited in the braking system. Rian started to countermand his last order. He pressed the transmit button on his walkie-talkie, but instead he held the device in front of Safronov's face. Softly, the general said, "Give your men the order to attack." The terrified Russian millionaire's white face filled with color in an instant of animalistic pride, and he shouted so loud into the microphone of the walkie-talkie that Rian was certain his call would come out distorted on the radios of his gunmen.
"Attack!" he screamed in Russian.
Instantly, the field ahead of the men in the shed flickered with the lights of launching RPGs. A couple streaked over the train, arcing off into the night, and one detonated against the second-to-last car on the tracks, but four more rocket-propelled grenades hit their mark on the engine, turning it into a fireball of twisted metal. Two more grenades slammed into the rear car, killing or maiming everyone stationed there. The AK chatter from the field was incredible, loud and angry and sustained. Return fire from the train cars took a long time to begin. No doubt the hard braking and the derailment knocked the men around inside like beans shaken in a can, and they were in no position to fight in those first seconds. But finally, large cracks of semi-automatic 308 fire from big HK G3 battle rifles began answering the Kalashnikovs in the wheat field. More RPGs detonated against the train, mostly at the front and the rear, but some of the Dagestani forces controlling the launchers seemed, to General Riaz Rian's way of thinking, to have extremely poor fire discipline. He heard shouts in the walkie-talkies, in Urdu and Arabic and Russian, and from across the dark rain-swept field, he watched the soldiers on the deployment train die. These soldiers were not bad men. Many would be good Muslims. Many would support Rian's cause. But in order for Operation Sacred to succeed, some men would need to be martyred. Rian would pray for them, but he would not grieve for them. Rian used night vision binoculars to watch the action from the shed. A group of 10 or so PDF soldiers managed to make it out of the train. They attacked into the ambush in a disciplined fashion that made the general proud to be associated with such men. But the ambush line was too wide, the force in the wheat field too numerous, and the men were slaughtered within seconds. The entire firefight lasted just over 3.5 minutes. When the ISI officers in the field called a ceasefire, they sent teams of Jamaat Shariat fighters into each car, one at a time, so that there was no blue-on-blue shooting between the cars.
This took 5 more minutes, and resulted in what Rian could tell just by listening, was the execution of the wounded or the surrendering. Finally, a radio transmission came over Rian's walkie-talkie. In Urdu, one of his captains said, "Bring the trucks." Immediately, 2 large black dump trucks pulled out from behind the warehouses and drove up a wet road through the wheat field. A third vehicle, a yellow crane truck, followed behind. It took only 7 minutes to offload the bombs from the train onto the trucks. 4 minutes after this, and the first of the trucks full of Dagestanis had hit the Islamabad-Lahore road and turned to the north. As Rian and Safronov climbed into one of the vehicles, a long salvo of gunfire rang out from one of the abandoned warehouses. The weapons doing the firing were PDF G3 battle rifles, but Rian was not worried. He had ordered his men to pick up weapons from the train security force and then use these weapons on the 4 Multa men who, up until the moment the ISI shot them dead, thought that they would be returning to India with these weapons. The ISI had Dagestanis carry the bodies into the field and dump them. Jamaat Shariat lost 13 men in the ambush. 7 died outright, and the others, men injured too badly to survive the trek ahead of them, were shot where they lay. All the bodies were loaded on trucks. The first of the PDF response to the train attack arrived just 12 minutes after the last of Rian's trucks left the wheat field. By then, the 2 bombs were nearly 15 kilometers closer to the impenetrable metropolis of Islamabad. 68. Since returning from Pakistan weeks earlier, Jack had seen Melanie almost every day. Usually, he would leave work a little early to head down to Alexandria. They would walk from her apartment to dinner, unless it was snowing or raining, in which case they'd take the Hummer. He'd stay the night, getting up the next morning at 5 to beat the traffic for the 30-mile drive back to Colombia. She'd mentioned something about wanting to see where he lived, so Saturday afternoon, he picked her up and took her back up to Colombia for the night. They dined on Indian at Akbar, then they stopped in for a drink at Union Jack's. After a beer and some conversation, they went back to Jack's apartment. Jack had had girls over to his place before, although he was by no means a playboy. Normally, if he thought he might have company over later in the evening, he just gave his apartment a once-over while grabbing his keys and heading out the door to go out. But for this date, he had cleaned thoroughly, mopping his hardwood floor, changing the sheets on the bed, scrubbing his bathroom from top to bottom. He'd play like he always kept the place so spick and span, but he was reasonably certain Ms. Kraft would be sharp enough to figure out that was not the case. He liked this girl. A lot. He'd known that from the start, had felt the kindling of something on their early dates. He'd missed her when he was in Dubai, and when he was in Pakistan, he wanted nothing more than to hold her, to talk to her, to get some sort of validation from her that he was doing the right thing for the right reasons and that everything was going to work out. Shit, Jack thought. Am I going soft? He wondered if it had anything to do with the fact that 2 bullets had come within inches of ending his life in the past 3 weeks. Was that what was behind the feelings he was developing for this girl? He hoped that was not the case. She did not deserve someone falling for her as a result of some personal issue or a near-death experience. No, she warranted the head-over-heels feeling without any artificial additives. His apartment was pricey and full of nice furniture and modern open spaces. It was very much a bachelor pad. When Jack excused himself to go to the bathroom, Melanie snuck a peek into his refrigerator, and she found exactly what she expected. Not much, but wine, beer, Gatorade, and days-old takeout boxes. She also gave his freezer a quick scan. She did work for a spy agency, after all, and found it filled with ice bags, many of which had melted and then refrozen. She then opened a couple of cupboards in his kitchen by the freezer. Ace bandages, anti-inflammatories, band-aids, antibiotic ointment. She remarked on this when he came back to the room. Any more bumps and bruises on the slopes? What? No, why do you ask? Just wondering. I saw the emergency aid station you have set up. Jack's eyebrows rose. You've been snooping?
Just a little. It's a girl thing.
Right. Actually, I was taking a mixed martial arts class in Baltimore. It was great, but when I started traveling a lot for work, I had to quit. Ryan looked around the room. What do you think of my place? He asked.
It's beautiful.
It lacks a woman's touch, but I suppose if it had a woman's touch, I'd have to wonder about that.
That's true.
Still, this place is so nice. It makes me wonder what you think about that little dump I've been making you stay over at. I like your place. It suits you. Melanie cocked her head. Because it's cheap?
No, that's not what I mean. I just mean it's feminine, and it is still full of books on terrorism and CIA manuals. It's kick-ass, like you. Melanie had adopted a defensive posture, but she relaxed. I'm really sorry. I'm just feeling a bit overwhelmed by your money and your family ties, basically because I come from the other side of the tracks, I guess. My family never had any money. Four kids didn't leave much of my dad's military pay left over for nice things. I understand, Jack said. You probably don't, but that's my problem, not yours. Ryan walked over to Melanie and put his arms around her. That's in your past. She shook her head and pulled away. No, it's not. Student loans? Ryan asked, and then immediately regretted it. I'm sorry, it's none of my business, I just... Melanie smiled a little. It's okay. Just no fun to talk about. Just be thankful for your family. Now Jack was the one to go on the defensive. Look, I understand that I was born into money, but my dad made me work. I'm not writing the family name to the bank. Of course you aren't. I totally respect that about you. I'm not talking about money. She thought that over for a second. Maybe for the first time I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about your family. I see how you talk about them, how you respect them. Jack had learned to not press her about her own upbringing. Each time he had tried, she had withdrawn from the conversation or changed the subject. For a moment, he thought she would finally go into her family life on her own. But she did not. So, she said, and he could tell that the subject had just been changed. Does this place have a bathroom? At that moment, her mobile phone chirped in her purse on Jack's kitchen counter. She reached for it and looked at the number. It's Mary Pat, she said in surprise, wondering why her boss would call at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. Maybe you were getting a raise, Jack joked, and Melanie laughed. Hi, Mary Pat. Melanie's smile faded from her face. Okay. Okay. Oh. Shit. When Melanie turned away from him, Jack sensed trouble. But he sensed more trouble 10 seconds later when his own mobile rang in his pocket. Ryan. It's Granger. How quick can you be at the office? Jack turned away and walked into his bedroom. What's up? Is it Clark? No, it's trouble. I need everyone in immediately. Okay. He hung up the phone and found Melanie in his room behind him. I'm so sorry, Jack, but I have to go into the office. What's going on? You know I can't answer that. I hate that you'll have to drive me all the way to McLean, but it is an emergency. Shit. Think, Jack. Tell you what. That was my office that just called. They want me to come in for a bit. Somebody's worried about how we're positioned for the Asian markets opening on Monday. Can I have you drop me at work and then you just take my truck? Ryan saw it in her eyes instantly. She knew he was lying. She covered. She did not press. It was likely she was more worried about whatever bad news Jack had yet to learn than she was that her boyfriend was a lying bastard. Sure, that will work. A minute later, they headed for the door. They drove mostly in silence to Henley Associates. After Melanie dropped Jack off at his offices, she drove off into the night, and Ryan stepped in the back door. Dom Caruso was already there, downstairs in the lobby, talking to the security men on staff. Ryan walked up to him. What's going on? Dom walked up to his cousin and leaned into his ear. Worst case scenario, cuz. Ryan's eyes widened. He knew what that meant. Islamic bomb? Caruso nodded. Internal CIA traffic says a Pakistani armaments train got hit last night local time. 2 20-kiloton nukes got lifted and are now in the hands of an unknown force. Oh my God. 69. The 2 20-kiloton nuclear bombs stolen from the Pakistani Air Force found themselves, just days later, in the skies over Pakistan. Rian and his men had the bombs packed and crated into 12-by-5-by-5-foot containers that were labeled Textile Manufacturing Limited. They were then placed on an Antonov AN-26 cargo plane, operated by Vision Air, a Pakistani charter airline. Their intermediate destination was Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan. As much as General Rian would like to send the Dagestanis on their way, to get them out of his country and somewhere where they could publicize what they had done and threaten the world with their bombs and their missiles, he knew Georgi Safronov was smarter than all the other cell members and insurgency leaders, and even any of the government operatives he had worked with in his career. Georgi knew as much about nuclear weapons as Rian did, and the general knew he needed to put 100% of his efforts behind an authentic preparation of Safronov's operation. To do that, he would need two things. A private and secure place, outside Pakistan, to arm the bombs and fit the bombs into the Dnieper-1 payload containers,
and someone with the technical know-how to do this. Bilateral trade had increased precipitously between Tajikistan and Pakistan in the past 4 years, so travel from Pakistan to Dushanbe was commonplace. Dushanbe was also almost directly between Pakistan and the ultimate destination of the weapons, the Baikonur Cosmodrome. The AN-26 flew out of Lahore with its 2 cargo crates and its 12 passengers. Rian, Safronov, Khan, 7 of Rian's personal security, and 2 Pakistani nuclear munitions experts. The Jamaat Shariat forces traveled out of the country via a 2nd Vision Air charter that would take them to Dushanbe as well. Rian's JIM directorate had already spread bribes around Tajik customs and airport officials. There would be no impediments to either aircraft's offloading its cargo and crew once on the ground. A Tajik with the Dushanbe city government, who had a long history as a paid informant and foreign agent of the ISI, would be waiting on touchdown with trucks and drivers and more crated cargo that had recently arrived from Moscow. The campus worked 24/7 looking for the nuclear bombs. The CIA had picked up ISI chatter within hours of the hijacking, and Langley and the National Counterterrorism Center at Liberty Crossing spent the intervening days looking into ISI involvement. NCTC had more information on Riaz Rian, some of it courtesy of the campus, and much of it thanks to the work of Melanie Kraft. So Jack Ryan and his fellow analysts found themselves virtually looking over the shoulder of Kraft for much of the time. It made Ryan feel creepy. But if there was anything actionable that Melanie found in her research, the campus was in a position to act immediately. Tony Wills had been working with Ryan. More than once he had looked at Melanie Kraft's research and commented, "Your girlfriend is smarter than you are, Ryan." Jack thought Wills was half right. She was smarter than he was, true, but he wasn't sure she was his girlfriend. The Pakistanis did an admirable job hiding the loss of the 2 nuclear devices from their own public and from the world's press for 48 hours. During this time, they scrambled to find the culprits and locate the bombs, but the Pakistani Federal Investigation Agency came up empty. There was an immediate fear that it had been an inside job, and there was a related fear that the ISI was involved. But the ISI and the PDF were infinitely more powerful than the FIA, so these fears were not effectively explored as part of the investigation. But when the news finally got out that there had been a massive terrorist attack within Pakistan on a rail line, the Pakistani press put together, through their sources in the government, that nuclear devices had been on board the train. When it was confirmed, within hours, that the 2 devices, type and yield unspecified, had been hijacked by parties unknown, it came with a very public and very specific promise from the highest quarters of power in the military, civilian government, and the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission that the theft of the weapons was of no great consequence. It was explained that the devices were equipped with fail-safe arming codes that one would need to render the devices active. All the parties who said this publicly firmly believed what they were saying, and it was true, although one of the parties did leave out a critical morsel of information that was highly relevant. The director of the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission did not tell his peers in the government and military, and he did not tell the public at large, that 2 of his top weaponization physicists, 2 men able to bypass the arming codes and reconfigure the detonation systems, had gone missing at the exact moment the bombs were lost. The next morning, the 2 crates claiming to be property of Textile Manufacturing Limited sat on a dusty concrete floor in the center of a warehouse at a school bus fleet maintenance yard on Kurban Rakhimov in the northern part of Dushanbe. General Rian and Georgi Safronov both were very happy with the choice of facility for this portion of the mission. The property was massive and fenced and gated on all sides, blocking the view from the tree-lined streets of the more than 50 foreign men working and patrolling the grounds inside. Dozens of trucks and school buses sat in various states of operational condition, which made the Dagestani and Pakistani trucks invisible, even from the air. And the large maintenance building was large enough for several buses, which made it more than large enough for the huge bombs. Further, there was a large array of hoists and rolling stands to lift and move the massive school bus engines that were scattered around the facility. Of the people present, the only ones doing anything more than standing around were the 2 scientists who work for PAEC, Pakistan's Atomic Energy Commission. They were missing back in Pakistan, and the few people who knew about their disappearance, but did not know the men themselves, suspected they had been kidnapped by a terrorist force. But those who knew them and knew of the missing nukes did not think for a moment that anyone was forcing them to do anything. That they were Islamic radicals was widely known among their peers. On this matter, some had been accepting, and some had been uncomfortable yet quiet. Both of these groups of people suspected these men were involved. The two scientists, Dr.